it's just such an emotional movie. One of the reviews I read of that movie is that this is an acting buffet for Will Smith, and it absolutely
is. Acting buffet.
Yeah.
Not just an extravaganza, like, not Oscar winning, no. But like a buffet, because there's going to be some mac and cheese.
Yes, it's everything.
It's all the cheesy. Bibliomancy is more than just foretelling the future based on a random passage pulled from a book. Trey and Jenny discuss the many meanings and messages from beyond that came packaged in the stories we are obsessed with, the movies that changed our lives, and the characters that explained who we are to ourselves. We also discuss where those messages came from. Well, hello, and here we are again.
Yay. Happy Tuesday. How are you, my dear?
I am in need of some media comfort. You know, there's this idea that people go back to some of their favorite movies because, like, it's comforting, it's nostalgia, and sometimes you go back to movies because there's, like, some sort of a compulsion in you. And I think that we're both big media nerds, and media is just a big part of our lives.
Well, and it's truly incredible because I was like rewatching The Dark Knight recently for the 1,000th time. And I'm like, it's amazing how many times you can see a movie that's really good and then you're still rewatching it and you're like, I'm just enjoying this as much as I did the first time. So it's really impressive that movies have that ability, or just storytelling in general has that ability. Cause you could probably say the same thing about books, but yeah, comfort movies.
Comfort movies, you know, and there's like reasons why there are comfort movies. And, you know, I'm a creative writing teacher. So this is a big part of, what I think about all day, every day. And, you know, we're both filmmakers, mm-hmm. But we're both really sensitive people. And we both figured out that we were using media, you know, as bibliomancy. And do you have a definition for bibliomancy, or should I give them the dictionary one?
Well, I like your dictionary definition a lot. I guess I'll just say, because bibliomancy is a new term for me, and actually I didn't start thinking about it until we started this podcast. And I guess for me, it's this idea that stories are a really, really raw kind of magic, and that I think that they have a way of breaking down people's walls internally a lot more effectively than just conversations do. And so, yeah, I've always said movies can force empathy on people who don't otherwise practice it.
God, that's so good. Say that again. That was amazing.
And I'm only saying movies because I'm a movie, you know, slut, but like movies force empathy on people who don't otherwise practice it. Because, like, you know, there's always the classic story of the Rwandan genocide and how nobody gave a crap, regardless of what news was reporting in this country. Nobody gave a crap until Don Cheadle hopped on that screen for Rwanda genocide, and then suddenly everybody cares, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. And I just came off of watching Rounders again, which is a 1998 movie with Matt Damon, who was, you know, hot off of Good Will Hunting, and Ed Norton, who was, they're both up and coming dudes. And I'm like, why am I watching this again? And it really ties into what we're talking about with bibliomancy, which is for you and I, and for many, many, many people who choose to kind of pay attention, our media speaks to us and tells us things that we need to hear. You know, I think sometimes bibliomancy can be reduced to like looking at the future, but really, like, it's pep talks. It's, hey, you forgot this thing, or you don't know this thing, or like you come to it with a question and like it answers your question. I am forever sitting down and being like, why am I watching this? And then there'll be like a line of dialogue and I'll be like, oh, that's why. Like my internal instincts or whatever couldn't get through to me. So my spirit guides speak to me through my media. And you're nodding. So like, sounds like this is something for you.
I, you know, now that we're having this conversation, it's truly dawning on me that bibliomancy and storytelling truly is a form of divination, you know, where you're just tapping into your deepest self. Anytime I have to write, I always try and sit down with a movie beforehand to get me into the zone. And there'll be movies that don't connect with what I'm writing at at all. And then when I'm watching it, there is a connection piece. And it's like, this is the piece that I was missing. My spirits knew that this is what I needed. So they made me watch this movie. You know? Oh,
that's uncanny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's like the this level, so like the physical realm level of it, where I know a lot of writers who will design like playlists, so music, for example, and yeah, they'll be like, too. Oh, because it's the tone, it's the mood, it's the atmosphere. But when you take this one step further, it's like, but what is the song about? And then you suddenly realize that you were propping yourself up with like the themes of whatever it is that you were writing are reflected in this. And it's working on your subconscious so that, you know, you're working the themes of things on a different level so that you can just carry on getting the story out. At least that's my theory and I'm sticking to it.
Well, and I think, you know, to progress, like films in particular, just the visual versus auditory component, I truly think they're a kind of art that is just so much more approachable for everybody. And the fact that they can also heighten music, you know, and that there's so many films who just have iconic scenes that just have iconic music to them that you'll just never forget. And it makes the entire movie, whether it's a soundtrack or a score, you know, it's just like, you know, one of the movies I'm going to talk about today is Moonlight. And that movie just tore through time I saw it. And that soundtrack is amazing. It's so good. So I feel like watching and then also listening, it's engaging a lot more of your senses than other forms of storytelling often do. There's a particular magic behind that too.
Yeah. Yeah. When we say movies, we also mean like TV, you know, or like whatever kind of storytelling you are consuming. So it could be, you know, a podcast that's a piece of fiction or creative nonfiction. So I do consume a lot of nonfiction at this point. When I got really heavy into the psychic studies, it was required of me to start listening to my elders, shall we say. And some of my elders, by the way, are younger than me because they just know things that I don't know yet. And I want to hear them talk. And I will do this all the time where I'll be in whatever mental state I'm in or psychic state that I'm in. And invariably my phone will just serve me up exactly the right, video that speaks to whatever it is that I'm going through. And I'll be like, oh, thank you very much. I needed that. You know, I needed to get my head straight and this did it for me. I don't know. Are there consistent things that you go back to because it helps you?
Yeah.
You feel settled and focused.
I mean, for me, one of my favorite genres of movies is political thrillers because my brain, when it's functioning and I'm in what I would call ADHD flow, it's like this. It's just snapping along. And I would say political thrillers usually have that kind of tone where somebody's talking fast and walking fast and then, big revelation, big motion behind revelation.
And not that person, they were on our side.
Yeah, and believe it or not, one of my favorite movies to go back to, which is going to make me sound like a psychopath, is Spotlight. With Michael Keaton.
Spotlight,
it's the one about them uncovering the Catholic priest scandal and about the Washington Globe specifically doing a huge report on it. And there's so many people in it. And it's one of those that just has a really effective way of pulling your heartstrings. And I don't care how many times I've seen that movie, my mouth is always going to be open by the end of it where I'm just like, you know, just shocked. And it's just so good. And the music's so good. So I would say I have movies that I have to return to. But like also there's been so many times where the movie that I'm watching will then spark a situation outside of that or vice versa. And they really coincide. It happens a lot with anxiety where like, I remember I watched Requiem for a Dream recently again.
And then yes.
While I was watching that, something happened with one of my friends and it was like really anxiety inducing. And I was watching this really messed up movie while I was watching it. So I was just,
you got to explain it. Like tell people what Requiem is. What's it about?
It's the most effective anti-drug movie you'll ever watch.
Because it really makes you feel like what it is to be wrecked by drugs. Well, it's Darren Aronofsky, probably his first or one of his very, very first movies.
It's the one he's most known for because he had only done two before that or just one. I think he only did Pi before that. And for those who know Darren, he has a tendency to find the biggest form of drama he can find out of the situation and pull it out and just make it the most dramatic that it possibly can be. And in Requiem for a Dream, every single character in that movie just has the most horrible dramatic ending you can think of. And it's just like, oh my gosh, it's not something I recommend. Like, it's great. It's a great movie. You know, baby Jared Leto.
So just to kind of, to reset things. So, you know, in the beginning, stories are really there to give us instruction. When we were all around the campfire, it was all about, like, this is how to be a citizen in this particular society. So humans have always looked to stories to understand how the world works. And I would say half of what I know about the world has come from the consumption of media. So anybody who sits there and says, those Gen Xers, they were raised by TV and look at them now. I'd be like, yeah, look at us now. We have the wisdom of thousands of great minds and some pretty crappy ones, you know, that is swimming around in here. And so we should be a human human bibliomancy machines, because we just know all the things. I feel bad for people who are not consuming story, because they're losing out on this amazing opportunity to, you know, see themselves in the media, to gain aspirational representation, to, you know, to see what the potential is. You know, I've never gotten to travel the world, but you know what? I have too, because I've watched so many movies that are all over the world. And guess what? As it turns out, your brain doesn't know the difference. So if you're watching a thriller, you still get that flood of dopamine and serotonin, and your body thinks it's happening to you. This is why we love horror movies, right? Because they terrorize us without actually having to have, you know, exes involved. So when people give us movies where we're traveling the world, like, I kind of sort of get to have that experience anyway. Sorry, I was just jagging. I'm a really big fan of books. I'm a really big fan of movies. I've dedicated my life to them, and I'm so excited when I find somebody like you. So what's the first movie that you could remember that, like, just lit you up? Or TV or whatever, book?
So there's movies that I always really liked as a child that I was like, oh, this is fun, this is exciting. I think the first movie that truly pulled on my heartstrings and truly started getting me on this emotional path, and it's funny because I actually just rebought it on Blu-ray and I rewatched it. It's I Am Legend with Will Smith.
Yes.
The alternate ending to that movie is garbage.
It's so garbage.
It tried to be like the book. It's not like the book, but it's just such an emotional movie. One of the reviews I read of that movie is that this is an acting buffet for Will Smith, and it absolutely
is. Acting buffet.
Yeah.
Not an extravaganza, like, not Oscar winning, but like a buffet, because there's going to be some mac and cheese.
It's everything.
It's all the cheesy. No, he was actually pretty exceptional. So explain what I Am Legend is, and how interesting that this was something that really connected with you.
It's just about being the last person on Earth, and not on Earth, but like, he's the last person and everybody else has turned into a vampire or is dead because they tried creating a cure for cancer and then it ended up working too well and turned him into a zombie. And so
those
he's
are the alternatives.
Like, yes. Yeah, of course. And so he's the last person, so to speak. And it's just him and his dog. And I think for me, the reason it hit is because I've always been a depressed person. And that movie is just depression. It is so good. Just being alone, you know, the scenes where he talks to the mannequins and has a relationship with these mannequins, but like, it's real. And then spoilers for I Am Legend, you know, the scene where he ends up losing his dog. And how it happens.
Destroys everyone.
Destroys. And then,
you
know, they follow up that scene with him re-talking to the mannequins and realizing his mind is breaking. And it's just about a man who has truly lost everything. And what is he still fighting for? And that question just kind of gets turned over a lot. And it does, unfortunately, take a really religious turn at the end. But beyond that,
because Will Smith always plays the Messiah. That is his jam.
Yes, he does.
Him and Tom Cruise are like vying for. It's true.
You did not just Will Smith and Tom Cruise. Two sides of the same coin. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. But yeah, it's just, I think that movie just really hit my strings about depression and showed me, you know, through bibliomancy that I was probably going to be a really depressed person in this life because these are the emotions that hit me hardest, you know, and I would watch them over and over and over and over again.
Oh my goodness. But it's also really about, you know, being so isolated. And I think that there's a lot of us who do feel like it doesn't matter if we're surrounded by a bunch of people, that, you know, that we don't have the human connection. And I imagine, like, gosh, after the COVID sequester, everybody needs to go watch I Am Legend.
Yeah.
Because it really just speaks to, well, what do you do? What do you do with yourself? And the fact that what I took from it, I took a lot from it, but one of the things was that he had himself on a schedule. You know, there are things that he did. He had to grow his own food. By then, the deer had come back into New York City, so he had to hunt. He had to check on the monsters and make sure they were staying at bay. He lived his life as if there was a reason to live, even though we're the audience being like, there's no reason. Why are you still hanging in there, dude? Yeah. That's what I took from it is you can still do things, even when you're like, but why?
Which is really funny to hear because now my biggest lesson right now is how badly I need a schedule to function. So it's like, it's always been there. It's always been there.
Get me back to I Am Legend. Yeah. All the answers to how to withstand a world that has forsaken us is right there. I also like that he kept media alive. He understood that, like, escapism and entertainment, you know, so he had a generator and he would watch movies. And I can't remember what the movie was, but it was, you know, it was thematically resonant for what he was going through.
It was Shrek. It was Shrek.
No, stop. It was Shrek.
Yes, it was Shrek. And, you know, because he finds the family and then the kid comes and he's watching Shrek and he starts word for word quoting Donkey's lines. And he's like, I love Shrek.
Wow. So Will Smith was the ogre in the swamp until he found his family. I want to talk about another Will Smith movie that he actually played. We're talking about, like, you know, Jared Leto and people wanting to play against the typecasting. So one of the things that happens with artists, and I don't care what kind of art you participate in, there's like a big burning question inside of you, and your art is the thing that you are driven to use as a way to untangle it, to readdress it, to spin it in a lot of different directions and to try to, you know, appease this itch. And one of the things that I've noticed is in filmmakers, if they ever get the answer to that question, they turn into just rubbish storytellers because there's nothing burning inside of them anymore. So it's wonderful as an artist, as a filmmaker, to have a good sense of what it is that you are fixated on. And there's a movie called Hancock, and everybody hates this movie, and I am obsessed with this movie.
It's so good. Why do people hate it? It's
because it doesn't it doesn't follow the Hollywood formula at all.
No, it does not.
So we meet Will Smith, who is, he's got superpowers, but he's a drunk. He is belligerent. He destroys things and doesn't care. And everybody hates him. They hate him, even though he's got these powers to, like, save the world. He's got no focus. He's got no purpose. He's just a really desolate person. So once again, Will Smith depressed. Which is him being like, I am not the Fresh Prince of Bel Air. So what ends up happening is his manager, who's played by the ever wonderful Jason Bateman, is like, we've got to rehabilitate your image. So it's creating this external personality that isn't really him, but it's so the world can, like, find him more palatable. I don't know, send a little less hate his way. And it turns out that Jason Bateman inexplicably is married to Charlize Theron, who's like, you know, if Jason's a 7, like, you know, Charlize is like a 20. So it's like, I don't understand.
Oh my God, yes.
Okay, we'll just go with it. Anyway, and it turns, and they have this, you know, like Will and Charlize have this great chemistry. It's like, what's going on here? And what it ends up being, I mean, it's a love story. It turns out that they're both gods. She has forgotten herself. She does not remember. She thinks she's a human being. And Will
It's the other way around.
Oh, wait. Yeah, yeah. Am I getting it wrong?
She remembers vividly because she's their brother and sister. And he doesn't remember that he's a god, but she does. And she's like, you have to stop this. Like, you know, and she doesn't want it all spoiled and stuff. So, yeah.
They're not brother and sister, though. Oh, no, now we're messing it up. Okay, this is how I remember it, and I could be wrong, that they were two gods who replayed this life over and over and over again, and they always find each other again, and most of the time they can't get it together. They can't have the big epic romance, or they have the big epic romance for just a small amount of time, and then they are shot-putted into another lifetime. And they have to find their way back to each other again. And you're looking like...
Oh, you're right. No, you're right. Because at first she was trying to convince him that they were siblings, but he wouldn't believe it. So you're right. And it is kind of... You're right. It's such a beautiful romance then. Because it hits on the same beats as I Am Legend, where it goes back to the loneliness. Because they can't be together, you know?
Right. So here's the uncanny thing. As it turns out, when I go through my favoritest movies, they almost always are about people whose potential has somehow been diverted. Whether there's, you know, supernatural shenanigans or, you know, trauma in childhood. And it's this movie where they have to kind of fight their way through this oppressive situation in order to become their full and complete awesome selves. Well, hello, first off, that's just being human, y'all. Like, we get to, you know, Hancock is the way things are. We forget who we come into this life. We don't remember that we are eternal beings. We take on all this trauma. We have to fight through the trauma. Once we get through the trauma, then we start to remember how, you know, galactic we actually are. And then how far down the road do we get to connect with those superpowers again? You know, and get to feel love and get to feel the, you know, the right kind of purpose versus the like American capitalist dream kind of purpose. Right. Yeah, there's a whole list. When I was preparing for this episode, I was like, oh my gosh, these are always the movies I really love, is when people kind of break out and return to their true awesome selves.
Well, and what a like classic structure for stories, because that also obviously fits beat for beat for the one that connects for us the most, which is The Matrix. And that whole line of Lawrence Fishburne being like, you starting to believe, you know, that's very much how it feels coming into your adult life in your 20s when you're a witch, or just in general, where you're starting to accept your abilities and your powers and starting to remember who you were. Wow, I really, really like that, because, yeah, there's a bunch of movies. Not every movie fits that, but there are a bunch of movies, and that's very... It makes sense for you and just who you are and the stuff you've gone through. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I think we all should have the opportunity to I just call it getting farther down the road. You know, this is your ride. This is the ride that you're on. But wouldn't it be amazing? So in my, I don't know what you call it, in my practice, the theory is this, that the more you evolve in this lifetime, you can retain that. So when you come back next time, you get to come back at that level if you choose. So hypothetically, you know, if you're kind of just, and I don't, please know, this does not mean like, oh, I have a big house and I've got fancy cars. That is not my version of success at all. To me, it's all about this connection to these greater potentials for humanity. Yeah. And then to come back. And one of the things that they're saying now with younger generations is you guys are coming in at that higher point, whereas Gen X was coming in buried in the muck and having to dig our way out. And so many of us have that we now, you know, are kind of parallel with what the Gen Zers, you know, what you naturally came into. I had to fight 30 years to get to. Love you. Meow, meow. Not jealous.
Well, I mean, like, it's all shades of gray because it's like, you know, like, it's kind of like, I know you're not a video gamer, so excuse me for just a second.
Bear with me. Go. Hey, it's media, man. Video games,
well, in video games, a lot of games have this idea of New Game Plus. So you finish the game one time through, and then you get to start it again, but you're starting again with your skills tree already decked out. Like, you already have all the skills that you had from the previous game. And so then there's ways that they try and make it harder. And, like, you know, because for me, I feel like I did know, like you said, I did know that I was full of potential at a young age. I did know that I had a really big role to play. I did know that everything I was experiencing in my childhood, this wasn't it, and that this was garbage and this was bad and that I had to survive, mm-hmm. and that I knew I just had to get through it. But it also didn't make it any easier, you know, because I would say a lot of my films that I clung on to, you know, going back to this idea of I Am Legend, were depression ones where a character felt this sadness that was so deep and so void tearing that it tears the fabric of the entire movie, and that you can just feel it all the way through. You know, and one that fits really well with what you were talking about too is like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Oh yeah.
When I first watched that movie, it wrecked me, because it's understanding, you know, coming back into this life with these previous skills, you're also relearning how to have sadness again and how to have heartbreak. And like, I don't know, I feel like there's a lot of stuff that I didn't deal with in my last time because I didn't have the layers of burial that I had to unearth.
Sorry.
Yeah. Exactly. And because I didn't have the layers of dirt to dig through, as you talk about, I was immediately dealing with that stuff as I walked into this lifetime. I was dealing with heartbreak as a child. Like, what?
I mean, you had birth trauma. We talked about that in your trans episode.
Yeah, that's like, true.
You literally were broken coming into this world. Holy Toledo.
Oh my God. In so many ways, too, with the hip dysplasia. Asparagus. Oh my gosh.
But not, like, totally relevant. Because we, you know, the movies that we end up getting attracted to, I'm just going to call it media. So it could be video games, you know, TikToks, whatever, wherever there's story, there are people who are devoted to that kind of story. So I think it makes a lot of sense for you that you were really interested in other people who were experiencing really big, heavy, I mean, some people might call it melodrama, but whatever, like, it's the human experience are these big, heavy things, like Moonlight, like, wow. So how old were you when Moonlight came out?
So Moonlight came out my senior year of high school. And it was at a time where I had just gotten my car and I was getting this freedom from my mom where I was allowed to do things on my own. You know, my mom and I would go and watch a movie every year for my birthday. And the year before, we had a really big fight, so I went and saw Godzilla by myself. And so I'm starting to form my own relationship with movies. And yeah, I randomly wanted to see a movie. I saw what was in theaters. Moonlight was in theaters. I was like, heck it, let's send it. And it was one of the like top five first movies that I ever went to the movie theater by myself and saw. And I remember just being floored the entire time because that movie's beats are the emotional beats. They're not story beats. You know, if you look at that movie, there isn't a clear beginning and end. There isn't a clear conflict that was resolved. There's not a resolution. It just ends. But it is such a good story about losing yourself and then finding yourself, just like you're talking about. But it's through the lens of what society does to us, specifically what society does to Black men and also homosexuals, and the roles that they are forced to play. And it's just such an emotional, beautiful, hard, deep movie. And after the end of it, I was just completely outside myself, like sitting in the theater. The lady next to me was just as floored, and I heard her say, wow, out loud. And I was just like, yeah, wow.
Yeah.
That movie, especially as a queer person who didn't know that they were queer, that movie just hit so many levels. It's ridiculous. Wow.
Oh, I just got goosebumps. Like, yeah, sometimes movies, media tells us who we are because we can't quite get a bead on it yet. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So Moonlight, for those who haven't seen this, oh my gosh, Oscar winning Barry Jenkins.
Yep.
Movie that he was on my radar for, kind of autobiographical. Yeah. It's told in a triptych. So three different storylines of him as a young boy, him in older adolescence, and then him as late 20s. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's a 5-year jump between each of the storylines. It's 5 to 10 years. I think it might be 10. One he's a six or seven, and then he's a teenager, and then he's in mid to late 20s. And it's played by three different actors, all of whom do an amazing, phenomenal job. The acting they got out of that child, oh my gosh. Unbelievable.
Was this child taken care of on that set? Did he have
therapy? And it's interesting for real, making this child say this derogatory word in a sad
let me tell you Gen way. Xers just terrorize little kids in Poltergeist. That's all we did. Look what you people do to your child actors.
Well, and it was interesting because Moonlight also had an impact on our society. Because you remember, it was the Oscars mess up. It was the one where, they come out onto stage to announce who the Best Picture winner is going to be. And Warren Beatty got handed a card that said La La Land. And he read La La Land out loud. And then somebody had to come up and say, no, it's Moonlight. And then the following year, white savior film Green Book wins Best Picture. It's like the Oscars so are trying. Yes. And it's like they had a moment where they were being progressive. Yep. And everything about the Academy was fighting that. It was like, stop it. Don't do this. Don't be progressive like this. Don't let this film about a gay black kid win Best Picture. And I remember when it won Best Picture, just the feeling that came over me was hope for it. The voices were saying, oh my gosh, this path is possible for you.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And it was right after
possible. That's it right there. That movies show us the paths that are possible. And I get so sad because so many of them have turned to the dark side, where it's like, how to be a villain, how to be an anti-hero. And it's like, nah, man, like we need the hope. We need the path to, and I don't mean like I think we're all in agreement that the hero's journey has kind of had its time. And it did its job for 10,000 years, but to be able to see yourself as a human being, still being loved, still being successful, still accomplishing things, is just so much more gratifying, in my opinion, than watching yet another villain story. So movies have always been this place where we can learn how to function as human beings, as a society. And we were talking about, post-apocalyptic movies, which were all the rage for 20 years, mm-hmm. to the point where publishers were like, oh my God, if I read one more YA post-apocalyptic book, I'm walking away and you'll never see me again, where we just became really fixated. But it also commercially was really popular because, again, it's like, let's explore this place. And at some point in a conversation, you had said the phrase creation through destruction. So I do think a lot of movies in, especially in America, that we use this device of destruction as a way for people to prove themselves. Mm-hmm. In fact, I feel like that's all of the hero's journey is, you're going to go through terrible obstacles. Things will be fraught. There will be, I don't know, harpies and senators and, cyclopses. And at some point though, you will, your natural, your core self as a human, will vanquish all obstacles and you will prevail. And then you will happily go back to the place of your birth and you will be welcomed and you will be able to, find your way in that society again. And that all of that became really non-functional for American society somewhere in the 2000s. And I remember when Hunger Games came out, there was some things that were really different about that. So one was the fact that when we meet Katniss, she's already in the throes of PTSD. I mean, that kid is mentally upset. And it doesn't change. It only gets worse. She goes through all of these obstacles and it doesn't turn her into a god. And she doesn't go home and everybody loves her and everything is fabulous. She goes home and she tries to drink herself to death. And I remember when I saw that, I was like, PTSD, hello, you are familiar to me. And for me, my entire childhood was always being attracted to stories where, because women didn't have starring roles when I grew up. Oh, no. It was always told from the male perspective, unless it was like a high school romance piece of nonsense. So whenever I saw somebody who was like haunted by their demons, like that for me was code of like, oh, this is Trey's story. Let's go watch this. And to watch people who really, and usually they're just on screen as, you know, heavy drinkers and they did something in their past that they can't forgive themselves for. And it's always that, right? It's always a redemption story. And then by saving the whatever in the end, they're sort of psychologically healed. Now, I always knew that part was BS, but I didn't know why, because as it turns out, science, you could do all the good things in the world. You can live an absolutely morally flawless life. And guess what? You can still be really depressed and really struggling mentally. So that was my draw, was looking for characters who were broken, and they never used PTSD until like the last, I don't know, maybe decade-ish, maybe not even that long, right? Because they didn't know the words. They were haunted. They were haunted by their demons.
Well, and all PTSD stories that you saw in film were so war-focused and were, oh, this is a movie about PTSD. Well, we're going to make it about war, you know? And it was about the men and coming back from war and dealing with war, you know? And it's like, PTSD is so much more complex than that. And there's so many more stories where people are experiencing PTSD. It's a really interesting way to think about it, because I agree, there are not a lot of hero movies where the hero doesn't come out clean on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, because there's morally gray movies where that happens. But the idea behind those movies is that they're getting punished for their moral grayness.
Right.
It's like, it's really supposed to be a lot more. Yeah, that's really interesting.
So the person that I always like to watch was Charlize Theron, because I feel like she was always playing her PTSD on screen. She was always choosing characters who had been not, you know, she didn't do anything wrong in her past. Something horrible had happened to her. And this was the human being who was trying to make her way through the world afterwards. Everything from Monster, which she won an Oscar for, all the way through to like Old Guard. I'm like, this is it. Yeah. This is the person who was telling my story. And that's kind of messed up. I couldn't relate at all to romantic comedies. I thought and I still think they're stupid, because that's just not my life.
Well, and it's, you know, barring the fact that we didn't get female leads for a while, when we did, it wasn't the feminine experience. And the feminine experience is traumatizing in this country, you know, and it puts you through the ringer. And I think that makes sense that, you know, we'd latch on to, oh, this is a more genuine, actual feminine experience, of somebody experiencing something and not coming out through okay. Truly, the only early 2000s examples I can actually think of are movies directed by women, you know, like Virgin Suicides or Girl Interrupted. Granted,
but man, they also, you know, they were stuck making women's movies. Yes. So even though they should have had a universal appeal, it was like, oh, look, you made a sweet movie about tortured teenage girls. Go make 7 more of those. And then suddenly they're like, but there's other things that I want to do. So it was kind of a trap. On one hand, like, they wanted to tell that, you know, that story that was being ignored. But the minute they did, it's like they were in director jail.
Yeah. Well, and it just goes back to that idea of, you know, typecasting. And especially the men look at Virgin Suicides and just think, oh, it's just this happy-go-lucky movie about women, and the tone behind that movie. Yeah, exactly. It's like, and the tone behind that movie is happy and euphoric all the way through the end. And it does that on purpose. That's the point. But I think a lot of people misunderstood that and misunderstood that's what it's saying, is that this is what we're expected to be.
Right. The two things that I always gravitated to as a kid were portal stories, like, you know, like Narnia, right? Like you step through a portal and you are automatically in a different place, which again, by the way, is just purely, that's what happens when you die. You go through a portal and now you're elsewhere mm-hmm. in the universe. So there was always a piece of me that was seeking out, reincarnation. How does reincarnation work? And I was an American, so these are the tools I have. If I had been Buddhist, if I had been perhaps born in an Asian community, I wouldn't have had to watch all of this junk TV in order to, mm-hmm. to get that this is what humanity is. And I love the fact that across, you know, Hollywood's been around for 100 years, books have been around for a lot longer, and especially in sci-fi, because sci-fi is 100% my jam. So in this world's version of things, sci-fi is always like a metaphor for some sort of a social ill, right? That we can't necessarily bravely take on it straight through, you know, straight drama, that we need some kind of Hunger Games in order for us to understand that this is a caste system and caste systems are bad, etc. But then there's that extra layer of things. So when I was a kid, my uber fixation, besides Jamie Summers, the Bionic Woman, oh my God, was Battlestar Galactica. So this is the original one, y'all. I think it was like 1978 or something like that. So I was like 8-ish years old. And so it's a portal story in the sense that the origin story is humans created an AI technology that then evolved and decided humans were nonsense and just started blowing up their planets. And what few humans survived jumped on whatever ship could fly. And then that's where your story starts, is these humans floating around in very, very, very contained spaces. They all had slightly different societies because it was like 12 different planets. So now they all have to figure out how to live together. Everybody has to be able to pitch in. Like, there's no such thing as a human that can just, I don't know, sit around and watch TV like I do. Like, I would be useless in that universe.
Which is such a 70s mindset too. Oh my gosh.
Which, sitting around in front of a TV or?
No, not being allowed to. Like, you can't waste your way a life away doing nothing. You must be involved.
And look, I did. Ha ha. I've gotten to spend my entire life and I've gotten paid to sit around and watch TV my whole life. Winner. So Battlestar for me was, it was a found family because everybody had experienced horrible loss. They were all kind of reborn into this new experience. It tended to focus on the military folks, but as the show went on, it expanded into like the doctors and the teachers and the people growing food. So you got a sense of how, so it was a post-apocalyptic tale. And it was worse. It was, you know, like just like on planet Earth, we're just floating around on a very, very, very contained space. And are we going to survive? And then of course they are being pursued by this AI, that wants to see them destroyed. And I went back to Battlestar Galactica during the sequester, and it was just so obvious to me that we were living Battlestar Galactica, that instead of AI, it was the COVID virus and it was trying to kill us.
Yeah.
And we had to stay inside of our little tin cans, man, and just keep moving, just keep running, just keep running. Or actually stay still, just stay. It's like that Doctor Who episode with the angels, stay still.
Yeah.
How are you? so that it was super meaningful. And then when I was older, I was always like, okay, so this was my big test for having, I only had a couple of friends at a time when I was a kid. I just couldn't comprehend having more than one or two friends. I was friendly to everybody, but like, these were my friends. And it only worked out if we liked different boys on the shows. And my friend was an Apollo fan, and I just was like, boring. I like Starbuck. And when I got older and I was breaking down the characters for some class I was teaching, so Starbuck was an orphan long before everybody else was an orphan. He grew up in an orphanage. His father, as it turns out, was a gambling addict. and had abandoned him. His mother had died. He had spectacular skills. He was the best pilot. So he found the military, as many lost young people do. Not lost. Some are lost. Some are very mindful in their choices in joining the military. I don't want to insult anybody. But he was a lost boy, and he found the military, and it was a found family. So his unit. So he was going to do everything in order to keep his unit alive, and then by extension, humanity alive. But here was the problem. He was still messed up. He was a womanizer. He could not, like, he can only deal with women on the most surface level, the idea of commitment. And they make a joke out of it. But I'm like, but that's the truth, man. Like, commitment is really, really hard for a kid who never had any real attachments until he was an adult. How is he supposed to know how to work this? He was a gambler. He smoked cigars. He was a drinker. And I was like, oh my gosh, like Starbucks was my role model as an adult because he had PTSD. Like, he was living what would end up kind of being my life. I wasn't very good at the hypersexualized part, but that's my fault. That's not Starbucks' fault.
He's blameless in that.
He's blameless. And part of his arc, he's one of the few characters in the original one that really had an arc, and it was, you know, him being able to accept love and being able to express the love that we knew he had for, you know, Boomer and Apollo or whatever. He couldn't quite connect with his humanity. He would rather just perform and be the best Viper pilot, the most daring, the most outrageous. He was always the guy that did the most crazy, crazy rescue missions. Because he had no sense of self. He had no sense, he wasn't fighting for his own life because he didn't value his own life. And I didn't understand any of this until like 40 years later. And I was like, whoa, Starbuck was one of the most complicated characters on TV. So of course he was my favorite because he was kind of living my life. So there you go. That's my childhood. Well, the thing that impacted me the most.
What a, like, ahead of its time kind of character, you know, and to have this character who represents these ideals that men are supposed to uphold and, like, you know, being the best in the field and whatnot, but still allowing the fault to show through and the trauma and the PTSD and the grayness of it all. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially for the 70s. That's really, really ahead of its time.
I think they kind of painted him, though, as like we didn't have the concept of man-child at that point. It was just like, oh, that's Starbuck. He's off gambling all of his wages away again. We know where Starbuck is. Where's the casino? I'm like, that's addiction, people. Like, why are we?
Now he's just a total man-child.
It's just a man. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, anyway. That makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting because sci-fi definitely exists in that field. And, you know, for me, yeah, I talked about I Am Legend, but the most influential movie for me was definitely Cloud Atlas. Comes from Tom Tykwer and the Wachowskis. The way that movie is set up is it's nearly a 3-hour movie. And there are 6 storylines that are happening simultaneously throughout the movie. And Tom Tykwer got to direct 3 of those storylines, and the Wachowskis got to direct the other 3. And when you're watching them, it's very clear who directed what. You're watching it and you're like, oh, this is the Wachowskis for sure, or this is Tom. For those who don't know Tom Tykwer, he did Run, Lola, Run.
Oh my God, one of the best movies ever. Yeah.
Yes. And the book Cloud Atlas is just like a Bible for a lot of people. But essentially, that movie is about past lives and about the idea that we are reincarnated and that we are still trying to achieve the same things in the next life, just in different ways. And that our paths continuously cross over many lifetimes and that we meet the same people over and over again. And it's basically just an examination of that for 3 hours. I think the book does it a lot more effectively. The problem with the movie is how do you show a character who was one race in one lifetime and another race in another lifetime, but still show it's the same character? So they did a lot of race bending. They didn't do blackface, but they did everything else, like everything else across the board, which was just
Tom
such
Hanks
a wild
Asian in One Life.
They do Tom Hanks as Asian. They do black people as Asian. They do Asian people as white people. They do black people as white people. It's insane. It's all of the above. Halle Berry does whiteface in that movie, which is the most jarring thing.
It's the uncanny valley where we're just like, I can't accept this. I can't accept this. This isn't quite right.
It's what's going on. Yeah. And I guess, you know, when that trailer came out, it was to a song called Outro by M83, which is one of the best songs ever made. They actually used it in a short film that we watched in your class. I remember the trailer just seized me, and I was just like, oh my God, I have to watch this movie. And I watched it and I loved it, even though I did not understand the themes that were at work at all. I did not understand them at all. But basically it was saying that we are just continuously doing the same thing to try and reach enlightenment or reach this goal. And it was, in my understanding, the first time Eastern ideologies really broke through in Western culture, you know, just for a second. I don't think anybody really latched onto that movie besides a few spirituals and film people. I don't think people remember that movie very well. But it's there. It's always been there for me. And after I transitioned and I, you know, did a bunch of psychedelic drugs, I rewatched The Matrix and I rewatched Cloud Atlas. And I was like, oh my God, I get Cloud Atlas now. And yeah, I don't know. I was always, I get it now. I'm on drugs. I get it.
I love that you just dropped that. So yeah, I did a bunch of psychedelics and now I understand. By the way, that has been the path for a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh my God. Well, and I mean, 2020, it was the pandemic. I was at home all the time. Like, what else was I going to do with my time?
All right.
You know, besides just shatter my ego. So
it's time to hack Cloud Atlas.
Yeah. Like, I feel like it's just tapping into the fact that everything's connected and that all of our pain is connected and that we are all here for a greater purpose and that we are all connected to each other. And for me as a kid, that was it. Just, we keep doing the same things again. We keep doing these past lives. Like, I was trying to tell myself about reincarnation without understanding that that's what was going on. And I was tapping into that without understanding that's what was going on. And then you rewatch it as an adult. Yeah. And then you rewatch it as an adult and you're like, just like with you with Battlestar Galactica, where it's just like, oh my God, of course, all of these things, like, yes, I get it now. And that movie's theme was that unfortunately things get worse in the future than they were in the past. So, you know, but yeah, I don't know. That's my spiel on Cloud Atlas. I think it's a problematic movie to say the least, but it's also, I think its heart was in the right place. It's just a product of its time, unfortunately.
Which was only like 10 years ago.
I think we're approaching 20, actually.
Are we? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. 2012. No, you're right. 12 years ago. My bad.
But, you know, the thing that you really connected to, so this is like an eternal question, and maybe this is like the last thing to kind of throw out there is, do we already have things on our mind that causes us to seek out certain genres, certain stories, because there is a conversation that's happening between us and the story, and we're getting clues out of it and we're evolving because of it, and we carry it forward, you know, it becomes part of who we are. Or is it like the opposite way? Do we become who we are because, I don't know, the Marvel movies were a big thing and that's all that you watched when you were a kid? Or, you know, video games that are all first person shooters. Like, does media form the person or do you form the media journey? Thoughts?
I actually have an answer for that question for myself.
I was hoping you would.
I think it's both. And the way it's always worked for me is I will know, like, my spirits and my internal path and my future selves will tell me what movies I need to be watching before I understand why. Oh my gosh, that's
so sexy. I love that.
Because that is absolutely how it happened for Cloud Atlas. Because if you watch the trailer for Cloud Atlas, it is not clear what that movie is about at all. But I watched that trailer so many times. And what I found out is that if it's a movie that is impactful for me, I will have forward memory with it. So I will watch a trailer and I will see this trailer, and through, immediately first 30 seconds of the trailer, I'm like, I have to watch this movie. I don't know why, but I know I have to watch this movie. And the movies that it's really, really important, there won't be urgency behind it. It won't be, you need to watch it now. It will be, you're going to watch this when you're ready, but please know that when you do watch this, things will change. Ooh. That's how it was for me with the movie Past Lives. That's how it was for a movie called Drive My Car, which won a couple years ago.
Yep.
I watched the first 30 minutes of Drive My Car and I remembered it beat for beat, even though I've never seen that movie. And I was remembering from watching it a lot in the future. And so I do think movies, for me at least, have helped form who I am as a person, and that I am now doing the work spiritually to make sure my back ends get those movies and have watched those movies, you know, and are going to start telling those movies so that other people can make those connections.
Oh, I love that so much.
So that's how I view it for me personally, because I'm very connected with movies before I know why, not after. Well, this was great. This was an interesting episode, but it was good.
Yeah, loved how freewheeling it is. And we got, I don't know, I felt like I got to say a lot of the stuff that is so meaningful to me about storytelling. And I'm so glad that I have somebody who enjoys it as much as I do. So thank you.
Likewise. Thank you. And this definitely, I doubt, would be our last movie themed episode, especially because movies weren't necessarily the full theme of this episode. So yeah, we shall return to this.
Yes, we shall. All right, my dear.
Yeah.
Well, cheers.
Meow, meow. Meow, cheers. Meow.